All right. Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, wherever you're listening from around the world. Welcome to Women in Environmental Science. I'm Sreni Nathapuntla, and I have Constance Chere with me today. Thank you so much for coming to the podcast, Constance.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Of course. And to get us started, could you elaborate more on who you are, where you're from, and what work you're currently doing?
Yeah. So I'm a PhD candidate in the geography department at King's College London, although I'm currently sitting in Northern Ireland, where I'm based about half the year. I'm originally from France, even though it doesn't sound like it. So I'm about to finish my PhD. I'm submitting sometime, hopefully, in the next, in the early spring. And my research focuses on marine protected areas, or MPAs, as a biological conservation tool. So my case study area is actually the Irish Sea, which is one of the reasons I'm based up here.
Wonderful. I love that. Like, you're traveling so many different places in Europe, and just like able to see what the situation, or able just to like be in different places, I think is a wonderful part. So what's like the main idea of your research? I know we talked about like marine protected areas, but if you want to like talk a little more about that.
Yeah. So marine protected areas are basically exactly what they sound like. They are protected areas that are designed for marine conservation. So the protection of marine life and marine resources in the face of human activities, to some extent, climate change as well. And they are a big part of the Convention on Biological Diversity's 30 by 30 targets. So that is to have the 30% of our seas and land as well in protected areas by 2030. So they're a tool that we use to try to achieve conservation objectives in the marine environment. They're also terrestrial protected areas, of course, but I'm obviously focusing on the marine side.
Gotcha. Yeah. So I think like I wanted to ask you, like, what got you interested in marine science in general?
Yeah, so I mentioned I'm from France. I'm actually from a small village on the northern coast of Brittany. So Brittany is one of the regions of France. It's on the English Channel, not too far from Normandy. And so I grew up really like on the ocean, on the harbor. And I grew up not far from the Sept-Îles Marine Protected Area. So that's, it's about 5 nautical miles offshore. And it is a nature reserve. And that was designed, but designated basically for the conservation of seabirds. And there are seals there as well. And it's a really important ornithological site. So I've always been aware that marine conservation was really important, and I've seen it in action since I was young, but I didn't get into marine conservation until much later on.
Gotcha. And what made that switch for you?
So I actually went to university in the first instance to study history, although I'm not even sure if that was my major when I got there, because I did my undergrad in the United States, and the US system is so different from the one that we have here in Europe, because here you don't get that year to figure out what you want to study. You know, our undergraduate programs tend to be about 3 years, so you kind of hit the ground running in your field of interest. And so we don't have to take those general education, I think, requirement modules. So I took modules, you know, in history, political science, biology, Spanish lit, French lit. You know, I wasn't really sure where I was going, but I naturally gravitated towards history. My grandmother was in the French Resistance during the World War II. My grandfather was a head of the French Resistance. So, you know, kind of the history has always been part of my upbringing. And then my last year at uni, I took an environmental module, and I thought, wait, where have you been the last 3 years? this is really, really interesting. And it was, as much as I liked biology, it was a little bit more geared towards, you know, protecting the environment, but what we can do to protect our natural environment. And Well, it was too late to change majors at that point. So I just carried on with my history degree and graduated. But when I applied to graduate programs, I decided I really wanted to study the environment. And I was fortunate enough to have gotten high marks in enough modules in natural sciences during my undergrad because of all these general education requirements and electives and all that. So I was able to get into the environmental masters at Sciences Po in Paris. And so I ended up studying biology later on, you know, the more focused view on biology, but, you know, that switch to the environmental master's program was the first step in, you know, making the switch from humanities to the sciences. And then, then after that, I worked in environmental sustainability for these big multi-billion dollar companies for a few years. And then I found out that I realized that, you know, corporate wasn't really for me. I decided I wanted to do a PhD because I wanted to exact change. And I didn't feel I could do that from within a corporate setting. And even though there are some people who are able to do great things through industry, I really wasn't one of them.
Yeah, I love that. Like, you're able to use, surprisingly, all those like general classes from your undergrad, and you were able to get your degree in natural science. Honestly, that's a perfect coincidence. So good thing for that. So kind of like going deeper into your research, as we talked about earlier, like your research probably focuses on the how effective marine protected areas are in the Irish Sea, and how they're sustainable conservation tools. So can you tell me a little bit more about the Irish Sea and why that general area is important?
Yeah, so I when I was doing my second master's, because after my first master's, I realized I didn't really want to do environmental health as much as I thought I did. So I figured out that I was really interested in conservation. And actually, if that's okay, I can kind of give you a little bit of background about how that happened, because to my research. So actually what happened was I applied to several PhD programs after I realized corporate wasn't for me. And I thought at first I wanted to do environmental health. And it turns out I was rejected from every single one of them. But it took me actually a while to realize I wasn't really interested in how the environment can affect human health, but rather how humans affect ecosystem health. And that's when I applied to do a master's program in conservation. And I ended up getting my master's at the Sorbonne's Institute of Geography. Mm-hmm. And so the master is called Bioterre, so biodiversity, territory, and environment, if you literally translate it. But it's an interdisciplinary master's that focuses on biological conservation and environmental management. And so I did my master's thesis looking at marine protected areas in the Irish Sea, because at first I wanted to study the English Channel, because, you know, that's where I grew up, and realized there was a lot of research going on in the English Channel, as, you know, as is to be expected. And my partner is actually, he's from up here. And I was like, oh, you know, I was visiting him a few times, you know, in the beginning of our relationship. And I was like, oh, well, what's going on here? We've got this entire body of water that also has a lot of traffic. And, you know, that's a really important dividing line, like a border. And so, yeah, I got interested in looking into the Irish Sea, and realized that it was less studied than other water bodies, such as like the North Sea or the Mediterranean. And I thought, well, why not? Let's see what's going on here. And that's how I kind of delved into the Irish Sea. So the Irish Sea separates the islands of Britain and Ireland. So it's in the British Isles, obviously. And it's a really busy waterway because it separates, you know, the likes of Belfast and Dublin from like Liverpool and Wales and Scotland. There's a lot of human and goods traffic, you know, shipping that goes on there. So, you know, that definitely has an impact on the marine life. And it is, you know, it's pretty biodiverse, such as much of the areas around here are. And I realized that, you know, there's a number of MPAs in that area. And I just, you know, kind of became interested in looking at how effective they were in this let's say less studied area of the world. And so that's how I got into it.
Yeah, that's wonderful. You just took something you saw and was like, let's study that. So in addition to there being lots of ships, you know, for moving humans, moving goods around, are there any other events, like things that affect the water, like human pollution and climate change?
Yeah, so I mean, there's also a number of like offshore, you know, wind projects and all that as well. But some of the sites that I look at, for example, the Solway Firth, which is it's basically the board, one of the borders between Scotland and England. So it's located in the northeastern side of the Irish Sea, and that because it's kind of like an inlet, a lot of pollution accumulates there. So a lot of litter. Especially there's a tremendous litter problem in sea inlets for two reasons. The first being that these tend to be catchment areas for a lot of cities and towns around. So the litter gets into the waterways, and obviously the rivers flow into the ocean. But additionally, because of currents can bring in rubbish from, you know, around the world. Like you could find rubbish that's been floating around from China or from the United States all the way to the Irish Sea. So because obviously, so you can control the litter that you're putting into the environment, but you can't really control the litter that's being brought from other places. So that makes it really difficult. And obviously the way that these, that some of these marine protected areas or that the coastline is shaped, it becomes easy for currents and waves to bring rubbish from elsewhere in. That is, you know, a clear problem that we're seeing, especially because there's also, water treatment facilities, sewage treatment facilities that are often located on our coasts and that end up seeping into our marine environment. And I'm sure you've seen, or if you don't know, there's been a lot of outcry recently because in the UK, or in England specifically, the government's allowed wastewater to be dumped basically into the natural environment. And so you can't go swimming in the ocean anymore because there's a high risk of contamination from fecal matter, for example. So it's not nice. Just to kind of wrap up what I'm, you know, that long-winded rant there, is just to say that there are a number of polluting and contaminating factors that end up in the Irish Sea, but not just the Irish Sea. You know, this mm-hmm. is something that happens on most coasts.
Right. We're just trying to study one part so we can study basically all parts and see what can we do to protect the animals in there and the people who want to be in there. So what are like some of the methods that you've seen put in place or have implemented in the Irish Sea or wherever else to protect that area? How are they different from each other?
So establishing marine protected areas is a really great first step. So the way that works is that they either designate an area that is that has important species or habitats that need conservation, or sometimes it's because they've discovered that this is an area where key species, for example, gray seals, for example, they like to they basically go there to give birth reproduce. So depending on what that area means or the significance of that area for the wider ecosystem, that could be designated a marine protected area. There can also be marine protected areas to regulate fishing, which is, I'm not a fisheries scientist, but I know that marine protected areas can be used to regulate fish stocks, for example. What was your question again? Sorry.
Yeah, no problem. So like what methods are put in place to protect the water?
Yes. So marine protected areas is one of the big methods. And then there are other smaller initiatives that can be implemented, such as, beach cleanups, citizen science initiatives, such as like Sea Search, for example. That is one of the citizen science projects that I'm involved with or Coastwatch, which is another one, Coastwatch Ireland, where basically citizen scientists go around and track litter and invasive species on Ireland's coasts. And then Sea Searches is designed for divers and snorkelers to record marine species underwater. So there's a couple of these different types of initiatives that help contribute to the conservation of our marine environment. However, you know, the main push should be coming from the local authorities, environmental authorities, such as you know, governmental offices, our trusts. And, you know, these are the ones who have the most resources to be able to implement adequate conservation measures.
Yeah, very true. Like, I think that what you just said about the push needs to come from the policymakers, like, kind of applies to like all environmental problems. We need that governmental push to get things started. So I wanted to ask, like, if you had the ability to make any laws you wanted right now, what laws would you make, or what laws or policies would you make about like the environment, the ocean, anything?
Yeah. So, well, for me at this point, what I've realized through my research is that there are a number of paper parks in, well, around the world, let's be honest. And so a paper park, for those who don't know, is basically a protected area, marine or terrestrial, that exists solely on paper. So it's been designated, you know, lines have been drawn on a map, but it doesn't have effective management or monitoring in place. And so, you know, at that point, what's the point? You know, if we're just saying this area is protected, but we're not actually doing anything to protect it. So actually holding governments accountable to, you know, to say, well, we've said that this is going to be protected. Now make sure that the resources in terms of manpower, budget, you know, that they have the tools that they need to be able to carry out effective management and monitoring, because you can't manage something that you don't know. So if you're not monitoring actively, you don't know if the conservation targets are being met or if they're failing. So for me, I guess, you know, what I would try to implement is a system of accountability to ensure that you know, the targets that we've set out for ourselves are met, and if they're not met, then there has to be some kind of repercussion.
Absolutely. I think once I understood like what paper parks were, I was like, that's kind of pointless. Just like seeing it's supposed to be protected, but it's not protected. And I think it's so important that we step up to its name and protect it. So kind of going a little bit back to your, like, tying your PhD work into what we talked about with the marine protected areas. So is your main research just focused on how effective are these, and is the marine protected area actually happening? So is that like the main idea of your research?
Yeah. So a marine protected area basically needs to meet biological conservation objectives while maintaining sustainable use. And when I say maintaining sustainable use, what I'm saying is that it needs to take into account socioeconomic outcomes. So for example, we need to be able to have a balance between how we deliver for nature by putting in restrictions or by putting in, you know, establishing protected areas, but also not forgetting about the people who may depend on, you know, the marine environment, for example, for their livelihoods or for their well-being. And there are people who live on the border or, you know, around or inside a protected area. And, you know, they can't just be neglected when it comes to the management of that particular site. So so that's what I'm looking at through my research, is how do we manage protected areas in a way that they end up being sustainable. And when I say sustainable, I mean from a both a biological or biophysical point of view and from a human point of view, so socio-economical point of view. And by doing that, I've worked with stakeholders, getting their feel about things, people who are directly impacted by the presence of a marine protected area, on top of doing the work on looking at whether or not conservation objectives are being met, you know, the site conditions, so whether or not they're favorable or unfavorable, and looking at whether what the species that are being protected can tell us about the state of these marine protected areas in terms of their habitats, for example.
Gotcha. And I think that's extremely important and very relevant to not only look at just from the environmental side, or not environmental side, but like the marine, like the biological, the marine biology side, but also the anthropogenic side. See, how are these affecting humans? So have you had a chance to like talk to the people who may be affected by these areas, maybe interact with them, tell them what your research is about and in trying to help them as well?
Yeah, so my second empirical chapter of my my PhD looks at equity in protected area, in marine protected areas, because according to the Convention on Biological Diversity, Aichi Target Number 11, protected areas need to be effectively and equitably managed, and so that equitable side basically means that people need to be able to be involved and treated fairly in decision-making processes for the management of these sites. And so I was able to run semi-structured interviews with key stakeholders. And when I say key stakeholders, it involves, people who are involved within the management, as well as people who whose livelihoods depend on the area, and just people who just live in the area, to get their sense of how the MPA is doing. And surprisingly enough, a number of people didn't even realize that the area was protected at all, that it was a marine protected area, and that there were some restrictions that were in place because there were no there was no enforcement of any regulations. So that makes it even more difficult to bring conservation issues to light if people aren't aware of what's in their own backyard. And for the most part, everybody is happy enough to protect the marine environment, especially people who live around it. They find that there are benefits that are, that don't even have a monetary value, especially for people who just enjoy being by the sea for their mental health and their well-being. So yeah, I've had the pleasure to chat to loads of people through my research.
Yeah, that's super important. I think with science, the most important thing is like doing our research, having it connect back to people, but also talking to those people and making sure everyone's on the same page. That we all know what we're doing and how we're feeling about things in place, because sometimes things get hidden, and you don't know unless I talk to people. So I think it's super important that you're doing that. Now, while we're on the topic of people and science, so I read that you were working on a bunch of citizen science projects such as Sea Search and Coast Watch. So can you elaborate more on your work with these projects?
Yeah, so I mentioned a little bit about them before. So with Sea Search, been on a couple, some dives with them, although I dive more in France now than anywhere else, because I'm usually there during the summer times working closer to that marine protected area that I mentioned growing up. And so the way it works is Sea Search trains divers, scuba divers, free divers and snorkelers to identify species when they go diving, and then all that data is collected and then put into different countries' databases. So Northern Ireland has a special one, and the Republic of Ireland has one, Scotland has a branch. So basically those branches compile the data, and then that's how you find out about, if species, new species have been recorded, or if there is a decline in certain species. And so that information can be used for policy making. For example, there's a marine protected area up here that that was designated because sea searchers realized that there was some important species up there that had been overlooked. And with Coastwatch, as I mentioned, is an all-Ireland citizen science project that where every year you go and you survey the coastline of Ireland and basically look at different, so whether the level of pollution, litter, or even any kind of of petrol pollution, anything like that, and then as well as any signs of invasive species. And then again, you know, that all that gets compiled and then is used to inform policy making, as well as scientific research. And so those are, like, you know, two projects that I had been involved with, you know, throughout the course of my PhD. But there are, you know, there's so many projects like that in the, you know, in the terrestrial as well. So if you're not a marine person, you know, have a wee Google and see what's out there and what you can volunteer or participate in, because, you know, there's a number of these projects. And what's great about them is because they are volunteer led, and it is all volunteering, you know, it's basically data that you can get for free to use for science. Because, like I mentioned, one of our issues is having adequate funding to be able to do the surveying and the data collecting that is necessary to inform management decisions.
Right. Absolutely. I think it's great that data is being used for policy, because, like we talked about earlier, policy is going to push things. Like, we can't do things without the policies for them. And we can't ensure that other people will do them without the policy. So it's really important that we do that. And also, just, like, I think it's absolutely, I mean, have you had any great experiences with that? Do you think, is it fun?
Yeah, I mean, if you're going diving anyway, you know, might as well. And it actually teaches you species ID skills, which I think are really important. So whether you're going out in a sea search dive or you're going out in coast watch, it'll tell you how to identify different types of seaweeds, different types of marine organisms, and, you know, what's invasive and what isn't. And when I say invasive, I'm also talking about alien species, so species that aren't native to the area where you are. And while, you know, many alien species pose no threat to the local environment, some of them do. So those are the ones that we need to keep tabs on. For example, sargassum, you know, is one of them. Japanese sea squirts is another one. So, you know, Pacific oysters as well. There's, you know, a number of these species that you just need to look out for to ensure that they're not, you know, either out competing native fauna and flora, or that they're not spreading, you know, diseases that didn't exist before.
Yeah, absolutely. Very important. I live in Pennsylvania, so I don't know if you've heard about, like, the spotted lantern flies, but they were everywhere, and they're an invasive species in our area. And just, like, seeing that and trying to think that might be amplified is kind of crazy, because the amount of spotted lantern flies were, like, was very, very large. Like, they were all over the window. They were everywhere. You couldn't go outside without one just being on you. And I think that just that experience has kind of, like, made me more sympathetic to invasive species and protecting the environment from invasive species. So that's, like, a very important part of scientific research, environmental science, just, like, protection from invasive species. So I also read about your work with the Gulf of Marine Research Institute for sustainable harvesting. Could you just provide a brief overview of what you worked on in these organizations?
Yeah, so the Gulf of Maine Research Institute was partnered with Sodexo when I was working at Sodexo, so between my masters. And so they were, I was part of the beginning of this initiative called, I believe it was called, like, the Maine Course, because it's in, you know, in the state of Maine, in the northeastern part of the United States. And so basically what they were looking at is, what they were trying to do is promote sustainable harvesting of seafood, and more specifically preventing overfishing of species that were already overfished, you know, for example, cod, for, you know, and substituting those species in Sodexo's canteens. So actually, a little bit of background information. Sodexo is a French company that, originally French company that has a company in the United States, Sodexo USA. But basically what Sodexo does is that they provide services to universities, prisons, schools, campuses, like corporate campuses and all that, in terms of basically their food. So I was working on that, on sustainable seafood, and I was working in the universities. So that was my job. And so this whole main course was about basically promoting the use of underfished species to basically prevent the overfishing of species that you know, that were usually on the menu, but they need time to recover their stocks. So, for example, instead of cod, they would be promoting the use of pollock or dogfish, for example. And so having people, you know, kind of shift their diets to eating, which basically, you know, a lot of these pollock, cod, you know, these are white fish. They're, you could use them interchangeably. So, you know, having people select types of fish or seafood that were more readily available than eating, you know, species that were at risk of overfishing or who were already overfished. And so it's actually, you know, working on that project that kind of made me think, you know what, I want to go into conservation instead. And I and made me really want to pursue a PhD as well. You know, I had already thought about it, but kind of thinking about overfishing and protecting our seas and, you know, thinking, because I had already worked on some marine projects, you know, in my previous masters. And yeah, it's just, I guess, the sea called to me or something. In that sense. But yes, that was kind of when I realized that I would be happier outside of the corporate environment, and I wanted to advance scientific research instead.
I mean, what a wonderful decision. You're here now, and I think as I can tell, you're loving it. So I think great decision. But yeah, research, like I'm extremely vegetarian. So just like with fish, understanding that a lot of the fish can be replaced with other kinds of fish is a very important thing we should all like think about. I mean, in terms of taste, I'm not really sure what that change of fish does, but I don't think it should matter, because we should kind of get used to it and be forced to get used to it, because just like protecting those fish that were previously overfished is the main focus and should be the goal. Like if we want to keep eating fish, we got to have fish. So I think that's important. But like another thing, when you're thinking of like sustainable harvesting, like sustainable fishing, we can think of like some of the people who do fish for a living, which are like people from low income areas, people near the sea who are just trying to that's their main income. So how do we prevent overfishing and promote sustainable fishing while keeping these people who depend on fishing, fishing these like big populations of fish that everyone likes, like cod, how do we keep their life situation intact while still, like, you know, being sustainable with it?
Yeah, so I think, you know, one of the things that's really important about remembering with sustainable, you know, seafood or sustainable eating habits in general is that it's really important to eat what's, you know, so the way that you would eat what's in season in terms of fruits and veg, things that you can get locally instead of having, you know, things shipped from around the world because you fancy strawberries in the winter, you know, that has a carbon footprint. And it's the way that, you know, we talked about how you could change pollock for cod. You know, if pollock's more readily available, then eat that instead of chasing the cod, for example. And I think that can really help with this, you know, sustainable fishing, because it encourages people to, you know, it allows people to sell what they've gotten. And so if they are fishing this, then that's what's going to be on the menu that day. And, you know, a lot of restaurants around the world do that. You know, the menu du jour, the menu of the day, what is the catch of the day, what has been caught today, you know, this morning, and whatever has been caught, that's what you're going to, that's what's on the menu. And so I think that that's a really, really good way of promoting sustainable eating habits, instead of, you know, it's not the end of the world if you can't have, you know, your salmon when there's no salmon available at that point. And I also think that if you adopt these kind of sustainable practices in your eating habits, then you're going to also have those the same approach to your consumption habits as well. And that can also be beyond, you know, what you eat. When in terms of sustainable seafood and making sure that people who rely on fishing for their as their main source of income, which is about, I think fish is the main source of protein, or seafood is the main source of protein for about 3 billion people on this planet. So, you know, almost half. It actually might be half at this point, because I think we just hit the 8 billion mark of people. So, and you know, there's nothing, you know, we can't tell them to find another job, and we can't tell people to, you know, eat synthetic sushi instead, especially in countries where synthetic sushi is either doesn't exist or is beyond the financial means of the majority of the population. So, you know, instead of buying from these, you know, large companies that overfish, you know, with their massive trawlers, instead buying from local fishermen is actually much better, because that money goes directly, you know, into their pockets. There's no there's no middleman in the middle that is taking their money. Or people, even if you go to your local supermarket, you know, they if you see locally caught, ask questions, find out where was it caught, you know, if it's local, where is it caught, who was it caught by, you know. And and even if fishers sell their catch to a supermarket, you know, it's still a they still make more money than if it went through, you know, the big industrial conglomerates. So I think asking questions about where your food, and this applies to all food. If you eat meat, you know, beef, find out where it comes from. How was it farm raised? You know, how did it end up on your plate? And then you can, you know, as you ask these questions, you can make more informed decisions about your food.
Yeah, I think that doesn't just apply to food. It applies to like your car, your phone. You know, where did all these materials come from? I mean, right now, I would say like I'm pretty sure they're not produced in a sustainable way, but hopefully in the future we can like change that, get them to be produced more sustainably, less CO2 emissions, and just like you can wonder like do I need a new phone every day, or not every day, every year. Do I need a new car every 2 years, or can I just like stick with what I have right now and, you know, prevent releasing that much CO2 in that production? And I think that just thinking in that way about life in general will help all of us be more sustainable. So do you think that currently the public and the government currently like care about the ocean?
I think it's hard not to care about the ocean, because the ocean is really our lifeline. You know, the oxygen that we breathe, you know, comes mostly from the ocean, and from, but whether or not the policies that are in place actually deliver for marine conservation is a different question. So it's really nice to say, right, well, we're gonna protect 30% of our seas by 2030. And that's, you know, that's commendable. The amount, you know, the percentage that actually should be protected is debated. Some say 30 isn't enough. But the key word here being protected. And I think that that's where a lot of policies fall through, is that, you know, they might come from a place of concern and wanting to see a healthier marine environment, but the tools to make that happen are not being utilized and may not even exist. So so that, you know, that key word being protection, well, what does protection mean? Or does protection just mean drawing lines on a map and then having, you know, reaching the area-based target, but without having any actual protection in place? Or, you know, can a protected area be considered as part of the 30% if it can demonstrate that there is active monitoring and management and enforcement in place? And I think that that's, you know, that's the big difference between what policy sets out to do and how things are, you know, in real life. So when it comes to people, I think well, it's really hard to tell, because, you know, some people have never seen the ocean before, but I think that everybody, part of people are going to be sensitive to the natural environment. I mean, you can't not be, you know. Even if you even if you live in an urban environment and you've never left your city, you know, green spaces are common in cities, and they're becoming more common in cities. You know, urban wildlife it exists and is something that can be a nuisance sometimes, but you know, it has its place as well. And yeah, so when it comes to whether or not governments care, I think there's a lot of talk. Unfortunately, I don't think that there's enough, you know, putting your money where your mouth is. And, you know, that's not just an environmental thing. It could also, you know, has to do with health, any kind of these social programs, or environmental programs, things that aren't really designed to make money. They don't get as much attention. And, you know, that's the sad reality of the world that we live in.
Yeah. But I think that's why your research and all the other like environmental sciences research is so important, because it's because it's showing us like, you know, what do we need to protect? You know, where do our problems lie, and really discovering like mistakes and uncovering hidden secrets of where, like the paper parks, of like where we need to go and actually protect the area. So I wanted to transition over to like some advice you would give to younger, maybe underrepresented people who are leaning towards marine conservation. And also, what do you need to learn in order to pursue marine conservation?
Well, first off, a lot of people think that if you want to get into any kind of marine biology type field, you need to be a diver, which do not. some people dive, some people don't, some people can't, for, you know, for a myriad of reasons. And then, you know, some people just aren't as interested in, you know, the pelagic environment as they are in the coastal environment, for example. So, you know, that is not a requirement to being involved in marine conservation. You don't, if you get seasick, that's okay too. You don't need to spend time on boats. Some people prefer it. And I think what you really like, what people should think about when they are getting into the marine environment is, you know, what opportunities are there for me to volunteer? So it could be, you know, you might not live by the ocean, but every summer, you know, you go on holiday to you know, to the coast. See if you can participate in a beach cleanup and see how you, you know, if that speaks to you, if you enjoy that kind of work, for example. Ask around about volunteer opportunities. It could be, you know, some, you know, 1 week a year, if that's all you can give at that point. I would say, you know, there's loads of resources out there if you're just interested in learning more about marine life. So, you know, there's loads of books, ID guides, so you can learn how to differentiate different species. Once you start going down that rabbit hole of the different types of marine organisms that exist, you know, it's mind-boggling. There's so, so many different types of species, really weird looking organisms out there as well. But also very beautiful ones and very interesting ones, from a, you know, biological, physiological point of view. So yeah, I don't think that, you know, if you don't live by the ocean, that shouldn't be any barrier. If you have no desire to be on a boat or underwater, that's okay too. You know, but having the desire, first of all, to do your part and to do something to protect the marine environment, you know, is the first step to becoming a marine conservationist.
Absolutely. I think that's super important. Some kind of like barrier we need to push down before getting to marine science in general is you don't need to dive or swim in the ocean or any water related thing in order to do marine science. I think that's a very, very important thing to put out there. Cause I mean, when I was younger, I would think I want to dive with, you know, dolphins and whatnot. And, you know, I was thinking, oh, let's just do marine science, but that's not all of it. There is so much more to it than just like getting in the water. And I think that's really important. So what do you need to learn in order to pursue this field?
Yeah, so depending on what you want to do within, you know, marine sciences. So some people prefer to go into like oceanography, and that's, you know, a lot of physics. Or, you know, if you go into marine social sciences, for example, those would be people who engage with local stakeholders, So they would be working with, you know, local community members, fishers, people involved in like water recreation, anyone who basically has a stake in the marine environment. So, you know, who look at different types of governance, for example, about how we govern our marine environment as well. So that's a field that, that somebody who might not be as interested in the natural sciences could gravitate to and still make a difference in marine conservation. So it really depends on what you want to do. You know, some of them are really mass heavy, some of them are very physics heavy, and then some of them are looking more at your communication skills, your drawing skills. You know, so there are scientific artists out there who really help with visualizing the marine environment and sharing it with people. You know, it's always really important to be able to communicate your research. So, you know, taking part in science communications conferences and all that is really great because it helps people understand what you're doing, and then it resonates a little bit more with them. And yeah, so those are some of the key skills. I think just like in any discipline, as long as you you're interested and passionate, I think you'll find which subsection of that field appeals to you the most, and what skills you have that you can bring to the table.
Yeah, very true. I think we need, there's so many different aspects of marine science or just like environmental science in general. It's so interdisciplinary and you can go down so many different routes. It's honestly your decision as to what you want to learn and what you want to pursue. So to close off our conversation about just marine science and in general, what do you think is the most important thing to take away from this podcast?
Yeah, I think first of all, you know, don't feel like because you don't live near the oceans that you can't contribute to marine conservation. You know, there's loads of ways to do that. Sitting at your desk, as I sit in my home office as well. A lot of my time is spent actually in here more than in the field. And you know, just to understand that while area-based conservation targets are commendable, that there is a lot of work that goes into you know, marine protected areas to make them effective, and that it's not just about the natural environment side of things, but there's also a human component that can't be neglected if we want our marine environment to thrive. Because if you don't involve humans, and humans are part of the marine ecosystem, in marine conservation, then you're not going to, chances are it's going to be very difficult to meet the conservation objectives, because you need cooperation from local communities and from local stakeholders as well. So yeah, I think that my biggest takeaway is, you know, if you're interested in protecting the marine environment, go for it. You know, I'm sure there's opportunities around there. You know, a quick Google will help you with that. And as well as, you know, not forgetting that there is a need for more hands on deck, you know, more resources to be able to adequately conserve our marine environment, so that we don't end up, you know, ending in a situation where it'll be too late, and that we have lost some really precious habitats and species.
Yeah, everything's on a timely manner, and it's a little worrisome if we're going to make sure everything stays intact on time. So if anyone would like to reach out to you, I know I did so through email, where can they do so?
Yeah, so I think the best place would be either via Twitter. Are we still using Twitter? I am right now, at least, until I figure out what platform to use next. So Twitter, it's you know, at Constance Chere, so S-C-H-E-R-E. So that's my Twitter, or on my website, so www.constancechere.com, or my email. So I'm sure you put all that in the footnotes, but everything is included on the website. That might be the starting off point. All my social media, LinkedIn and everything is on my website.
Yep. We'll link the website into the podcast episode. And to remind our listeners, we've been speaking to Constance Chere, and I just want to thank you so much for joining me here today and sharing your thoughts about, you know, our marine protected areas, your PhD research, and just all the wonderful outreach you've done and what other people can do. I'm sure people will take away a lot of things from this podcast episode. And I really appreciated talking to you. So thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Saranya.
All right. And thank you to the listeners for listening.